I'm Lauren Sega, manager of communications for Homeport, a nonprofit affordable housing developer in Central Ohio. We're in one of the fastest growing areas in the country, and while we've seen the growth, we've felt the pains that come along with it, especially when it comes to housing all of us and our incoming neighbors. Each month, we're interviewing local experts on the issues, the barriers, and the solutions around housing and development, hoping to shed some light on how we got where we are and what we can do to create a future that houses everyone. This is Level With Us. In part one of our conversation, we welcomed Catherine Gervis, Principal Planner with Tool Design, and Toby Otolana, Project Planner with Tool Design. Leah Evans, Homeport President and CEO, joined us as well. Together, we discussed how to better inform planning for housing and transportation by diversifying the ways we conduct outreach and solicit public feedback. In this episode, the conversation continues, exploring how we can use the data we gather to inform a more collaborative response that crosses jurisdictional lines and answers our growing community's present and future needs. Let's lay the foundation.
When you improve conditions for people who walk or bike, which might take away parking, that if the only story I have in my head as a small business owner is that parking is the lifeblood, it's understandable that people get nervous and
take away parking.
oppose the loss of parking.
This is Catherine Gervis, Principal Planner at Tool Design.
When in fact the data shows over and over again, when you improve conditions for people who walk or bike or use transit, you actually see increases in sales tax revenue from those businesses because sales are higher. But if people don't have the data, that information about, no, actually you're going to see more foot traffic, you're going to see more an increase in business. Like if we're not sharing that data, then people are making decisions based on faulty assumptions.
For sure. And it goes back to, as you were saying, we kind of sometimes created the policies that then fed that.
Leah Evans, Homeport President and CEO.
So if there's a zoning code policy, there's two parking spaces per unit or this many parking spaces for square footage of commercial space, then we've said, we've kind of arbitrarily put out there a standard that now people reflect back on, like, well, you have to have that to have the business work, or you have to have that to have the apartment work, when, again, as we've changed and people, the data really doesn't show that kind of utilization of parking spaces. That's space that could be used programmatically for a use, a residence or a business or some other or institutional use. Like, you could have this opening up of opportunity with the resources we have. We always talk about we're not making any more land. We only have what we have. How do we open up how we think about it and use it? But again, if that narrative is out there that you have to have this many parking spaces, and when you take them away, you're cutting off something from the business, if you don't have the corresponding data that says, actually, this is how people are shopping nowadays. This is how people are interacting with, you know, small businesses. This is how people are interacting with their grocery store today versus how they did that in, you know, 20, 30, 40, 70 years ago. It's very different.
As discussed in episode 5, Zoning In, the city is in the midst of some big changes to restructure the space we currently use and transform it from places to drive and park to places we work and live. As we work to preserve and create more affordable housing in the region, initiatives like Zone In and Link Us are important steps, but as Catherine and Leah discuss, they are pieces to the puzzle, not a silver bullet solution.
Every tool that we have isn't going to do everything, right? The zoning code rewrites, whether they're City of Columbus, I think Reynoldsburg has done some code updates, and a couple of our other peer communities throughout the region have done code updates. It's designed and planned to solve the challenge of getting more development activity, right? That's really our goal. We want to do it through an equity lens. We want to do it through with inclusivity, but really the goal is to get more development built. It can aid affordability and support affordability, but the designed is to get development activity to happen. And as you saw from the BIA's report, we actually have been down in permit activity in 2023 from 2022. So, really being able to spur and support growth and development. I think where the affordability piece comes in these other conversations that we're talking about. What is the policy goal? Mm-hmm. What do we feel like the public role is in supporting jobs? All work has dignity. Jobs that pay minimum wage. People need someplace to live, and we want those jobs. We call them essential workers during the pandemic, mm-hmm. and so we want those people in those positions to have affordable places to live that are safe and allow them a quality of life to go with it. And so, policy wise, how do we come alongside and mm-hmm. support with either programmatic needs, whether that's rental assistance, whether that's units that are more subsidized than others that then are going to allow us to bring affordability and integrate affordability into mixed income communities. So I think the zoning code is doing its part. There's a part it can do. And then there are other executions that need to be at the table, whether that's going to link us. Does that mean a pass for persons that have a certain level of income? I know the city has piloted things like the electric bikes mm-hmm. For low income persons and that they're providing those bikes. And so I think there are all these other possible program interactions that then allows them to support a population that is under 60% AMI, 50%, 30%. We see a lot of our households coming forward, and that's one of our challenges as an organization is we typically are setting aside a certain number of units that are at that lower income level, but it's set aside of a certain number of units in a building, right? And we get so many more applicants that need that unit because they're at 30% of the area median income or below. And so how do we have the resources to bring them into communities and have them, be in a place that they are fully supported, whether that's food access, different conversation, but I was talking to one of our peers, they do a lot of work in the insurance and healthcare space. They're a housing developer, but they found this niche in their community where they're doing a lot of health interactions with their community. And, healthcare is affordable housing because when we were mm-hmm. in the pandemic, many of the rental assistance applications we dealt with and we saw with our residents were related to healthcare issues. Not necessarily, COVID, but that they had a pregnancy and they would need to be on bed rest so they could not work. Or they had they themselves or a relative had cancer, could not work. Like all these could not work, right? Or and so that healthcare interaction is a source of resources and programming that then can support someone to be able to maintain housing. So long, very long answer, but I think there are programs and things that we need to invest in the community that can take that burden off of a lower income family in order to make sure that they have food, they have access to transportation, they have health care, they have child care, in order to then be able to have a place that they can live and maintain at the same time.
And what's the cost of not doing that?
Exactly.
Is the thing that we don't talk about often mm-hmm. enough. Mm-hmm. And what types of stress do we put on our residents when we sure. don't do that? So that people feel like, bringing it back to transportation, like the only place I can afford to live is so far away mm-hmm. from the places I need to go. Mm-hmm. And, what kind of cost burden does that have for me then on transportation? Do I now have to own a car? Like, mm-hmm. is it no longer possible to walk to the places I need to go? Is it no longer safe to walk or bike to the places I need to go? And we do have to talk about the complete spectrum of income when we talk mm-hmm. about affordable housing, even talking about people who are unhoused mm-hmm. and those are important conversations and important policies that if we don't invest in those, we're going to have to pay for them in some other way. We're going to pay in some way. So why not pay in a way that creates dignity mm-hmm. for all of our residents and allows the community to benefit from the resource and the brilliance that everybody has to bring to the table when they're able to participate fully and not be so distracted just by trying to get through the day.
For sure.
And now it's time to level up. The The investments and new policies Catherine hopes for will have to come at all levels and will require experts to step outside of their silos, understand the intersections of housing work and transportation work, and create a plan that is both future-forward and equitable.
When people are displaced, even when they're displaced only a mile, like the huge impact that can have on the social networks that you rely on to help you parent, or the familiar paths to and from a grocery store, and recognizing the importance of not just staying in our silos, whether that silo is transportation, the field that I work in, or affordable housing where Leah works, or any other number of things, the way these intersect. Like, I fantasize about interjurisdictional cooperation and inter-silo cooperation around what are we hearing from people? How are we knitting these plans together? Like, we do need to take things a bite at a time to get anything done. But when I take my bite in isolation, looking at a particular corridor without thinking about the housing work that's been done on that corridor, or other land use decisions that have been made on that corridor, or what the folks from the food pantry are hearing from people in that corridor, I miss important things that could influence my process. I miss important information that should be influencing my process. And I fantasize about like an engagement database so that we could reduce that fatigue, so that somebody who's been asked a question about transit, I don't have to ask them that question again about bike lanes, or that question again about housing needs. Like, they've probably told me the answer in a variety of different ways.
Or told someone.
Told somebody that. And like, as professionals, like, I fantasize about, like, if we shared all that information with one another, like, how much better could we be at creating beloved community where people have places they can live and safe ways to get to the places that they need to go on a day-to-day basis and have thriving families?
I think for like regional agencies or organizations that are trying to think about providing resources to help with that interconnection, I think keeping in mind like application processes, for those not to be a burden and to make that easier. I think sometimes, you know, with an organization have good intentions and want to like give technical assistance or something, but then the application for technical assistance is going to take a staff person.
You need a technical assistance to do the application.
Right. It's in like, you know, if your township has one administrator, I don't have the time to do a 6-hour application or whatever it is. So keeping that in mind, I think, will be important. And building it with input from jurisdiction, so it's clear like what role that organization can play, where the gaps are. I think I'll like plug Ohio Department of Health is an organization that has a vested interest in transportation and active living, and I think that's an underutilized resource in across the state, especially for townships and smaller villages. And also maybe part of that database or some organization that kind of brings things together is really highlighting those smaller grant programs, providing assistance for applications to grant programs. Because I find that for a lot of jurisdictions, that can be the issue. It's not necessarily getting the funding and implementing it. We'll hire a consultant to help with that. Mm-hmm. But like getting to that point is the issue. And so really finding out where those gaps are. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, regional cooperation or even statewide, we just have to acknowledge, you know, the context of our communities, the identity that people attach to place. And so if you do live in a township that has meaning to you and there's a choice there, and, you know, some, you know, suburban community or an urban community or, you know, more one of our more rural communities, there's, again, an identity that the individual attaches to that. And so the uniqueness of those places sometimes can get in the way of that collaboration, because they don't want to lose that identity, right? They don't want to all of a sudden have four lanes coming through their town because we've joined this regional collective, right? And so really wanted to acknowledge that it, you know, for us, and when we look at it from the housing spectrum, it really is, where's the gap? what's the need, mm-hmm. how do we, what's going on in your community, much like we say with the individual, what's going on in your community and where can we help address the housing need, right? And so I think it's very similar with the transportation. What are you mm-hmm. seeing? Are these township administrators, these county commissioners, what are you seeing in your community? What do you see happening? So now how can these resources, as you said, Toby, how can they be brought to help? What's the kind of help that you need? What's the right level and amount of support? And that's going to be a calibration for each different community in different ways. But I do think, you know, that that overarching collaboration amongst systems is key.
Yeah, I think the conversation has been largely around Columbus proper and all this growth that we're all going to be experiencing. But as we've seen, like, the affordability or lack thereof of housing naturally will push people out. You know, you drive until you can find somewhere that you mm-hmm. can afford. So, you know, it may be a Columbus problem, but Columbus workers are living in, you know, Marysville or
Newark. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So this is a, you know, it's a regional thing. It's not just Columbus.
Well, and vice versa, I think about all the people who live in Columbus that work at Rickenbacker mm-hmm. who may not have a reliable car. Mm-hmm. And, like, how do you get to employment there? Mm-hmm. And that's, like, I think oftentimes we turn to transit without having a land use policy that is transit-oriented development and say, hey, we decided to site something in a place that is completely inappropriate for you to reach. Fix this problem mm-hmm. that that we've created. Mm-hmm. And so coordination in that way is
How do we bring, like, corporations and, you know, job creators into that conversation?
Well, I think part of it has to do with land use policy. Mm-hmm. Like, how we have to be really thoughtful about what we incentivize and what we disincentivize, because we know where people live, and if a whole bunch of great jobs are going to come to a place that you have to have a car to get there, one, that cuts out a whole bunch of the population who could access that, but two, even if everybody had a car to get there, now what stress have you put on the transportation network? Like, this is how dangerous roads get built. You've got this two-lane road that now becomes 3, 4, 5, 6 lanes, which might feel necessary during commute time so that people don't have these horribly long commutes, but are incredibly dangerous any other time of day when somebody needs to cross that or somebody needs to walk along it to get to school, to get to other things related to daily life. And so we have to be very intentional about what we're incentivizing, what we're disincentivizing as these job centers get created.
For sure. I think, as you said, part of it is our business community, but as Catherine's representing, part of it is our public policy. What is it that we really want? What's it really that our citizenry wants and is asking for? What do we need? And then how do we work collaboratively to get there? So, you know, it's not, you know, business is going to pick a site that's in their budget, that serves their needs for resources, that serves their needs for being near talent. They're going to make, you know, business choices in that way. And that may be an outlier to a place that has transportation needs. How does the community respond to that? Does mm-hmm. the community say, okay, we're going to support this development deal, but here are all the people that are going to be at the table, and we're going to plan, how do we serve it? How do people get back and forth? How do we then site housing nearby? Here is the housing that already exists nearby. Can people get there from here? Like, again, being a part at the table of having a collaborative conversation when development opportunities are presented. Same thing for housing, same thing for planning our transportation and roads. If there's a new road project being planned, it should include a conversation about what's around it, mm-hmm. who's going to be impacted, what are some of the job uses, what are some of the housing uses, what are our young people doing, how are our seniors interacting, mm-hmm. like broadening our scope. Whenever we're planning anything new, our community is going to go through, as you said, we're already experiencing the growth, we're going to go through more growth, so there's going to be redevelopment opportunities as well as new development opportunities, and both of them should have the same lens and ask the same kind of questions about, wait, what else do we need to know before we put shovel in ground that's going to make this development successful?
I feel like it's an exciting time, too, with the federal government focusing so much on safe streets and roads for all. And looking at transportation through a lens of safety, specifically looking at these dangerous transportation networks that we've built that are resulting in fatalities and serious injuries, and drawing a line in the sand to say any death is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. We can do better. And bringing a equity lens to all of this work. I think the opportunity that comes with attention on those two things is not only going to create better transportation networks, but create better places for people to live and move around, and have us rethinking not only how do we address what is currently dangerous for people to travel along or on, but how do we prevent replicating those mistakes mm-hmm. in the future? And that, I think, goes back to how do we collaborate across the silos, which is another really important part of the Safe Streets and Roads for All program, is what kind of collaboration is happening with agencies that might not typically collaborate.
Different topic, but related, per usual. Catherine, I know this is something that's also very close to your heart, is green. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the federal government has been providing more policies and more programs related to transportation, but also have made a huge commitment to greenhouse gas emissions, investing in the programs and development opportunities that are going to advance sustainability in our communities. And I know, again, that's a topic that's very close to your heart, Catherine, is how do we incorporate that green building and sustainable design into some of these conversations too?
Mm-hmm. And I think another interesting thing that's come out, we saw this even before the pandemic, but it was really highlighted during the pandemic. People who have the resources to move by car, actually, if they felt safe walking or biking, if transit was a dignified travel experience, people don't want to drive everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that in poll after poll. Like, it's not just responding to what's right. It's we actually want. Like, this isn't, we don't lose something by mm-hmm. creating communities that are socioeconomically diverse and diverse in all sorts of other ways. We actually get something that we're already hungry
mm-hmm.
for
yes,
that
for
we
sure.
want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think talking, you know, having the conversation in that context too is really helpful.
And I think data is a piece of it also on the transportation planning
great
side.
Mm-hmm.
As we're building out networks or deciding what projects to do or prioritize or fund, a lot of the time communities will use data, and I think maybe there's an opportunity for some collaboration between
sure.
transportation agencies and housing organizations to think of some creative ways to be able to share that data in a way that's, of course, like respectful of people's privacy and things like that. But I'm thinking of a project that we worked on in Austin. They had a walking, biking, and crossings and trails plan, and they had a database. The city already had a database of affordable housing locations, and we could filter by how long it was affordable or what, you know, percentage of affordability it was focused on, and then as a planning team, we were able to use that resource
mm-hmm.
And, you know, use that to identify a network, identify projects, prioritize projects. And so I think that's something that could be really valuable for decision makers, that can factor into maintenance. Let's think about, you know, where these locations are when we're plowing snow
mm-hmm.
from the streets
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And so I think that's another area where we can do better to understand where those, especially like you said, 30% lower AMI areas are or housing opportunities are, and plan intentionally.
So what if we were intentional in our transit-oriented development and in our bike-oriented development and our trail development? In saying, like, of course we want a built-out network that serves everyone, but the place we're going to start is where we have stable, affordable housing, so that as we build this place that's attractive to a whole bunch of people and brings in new development, that it's not going to result in the displacement of people who already live there. It's actually going to invest in where in the people who live there to make sure that they get access to the places they need to go. Like, I would love to see that interplay between affordable housing and transportation, that we made that we allowed where affordable housing exists, is stable, is accessible, to influence where we invest first.
Mm-hmm. We can end on that note. Like, that's, I mean, that's the culmination of the conversation as it relates to housing and transportation. Obviously focused on housing that's affordable, but that incorporates a whole swath of job types and lifestyle mm-hmm. types and different choices that people are making and how they live, but how to be supported. They need to be able to get places.
Right.
And we can't lose that in our housing conversations. We can't lose that in any of our development conversations, is that people leave their house to do something. Yeah. And whatever those somethings are, how are they getting there is critically important to their well-being and their safety and their ability to live, you know, full, fulfilled lives. And so when we disconnect some of these conversations, like, okay, like you're saying to me, like, this is the investment in this, this is the investment in this, and this is the investment in this. Well, wait, what's our investment in community? And now let's prioritize. And yes, sometimes it maybe feels hard to prioritize a transportation project when you have public safety as an issue, or you have schools as an issue, or you have these other things. But when we look at the investments in whether that's housing or transportation, it's going to improve the outcomes mm-hmm. on your health. It's going to improve the outcomes in public safety. So when we count the costs, we should also be counting those opportunity costs that relate to, if we improve this, we will see a reduction in these costs over here, and that will benefit our community. So bringing to those conversations together, you said, like, that next project you see is going to be cited when we are ready to make a big investment in light rail, or and then it's going to be cited somewhere that's close to, in proximity to a mixed income neighborhood that has levels of affordability, and we're going to preserve that through mm-hmm. this transit investment, right? Mm-hmm. And so that you can build upon that, and it doesn't become, you know, some of the challenges we have right now around gentrification and displacement. Like, we've been investing in housing for 37 years, and, you know, many of us and our peers also now are finding ourselves in places where the neighborhoods we've been investing in have changed dramatically. And so what does that mean? And so what did we learn from that, and what can we do now on the front end to protect and preserve the communities and neighborhoods and blocks, even with our more strategic look at how housing intersects, in this case, with transportation.
Thanks to Catherine, Toby, and Leah for joining Level with us. Our next bonusode will wrap up our conversation with a little quiz on transportation and public safety, plus a couple reading and listening recommendations. Tune in 2 weeks.
Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.